Hi, this is the Glencairn Podglass, celebrating 20 years of the Glencairn Glass, the world's favourite whisky glass. My name is Gordon Brown, and today on the Glencairn 2020 Podglass, our guest is a director at the Keepers of the Quake, the exclusive international community of people recognised for outstanding commitment to Scotch whisky, with a mission to promote the values and image of Scotch whisky as the world's finest and most prestigious distilled spirit. She's also been a consultant in the whisky world, managed many prestige corporate events, was the manager and venue manager at the Scotch Malt Whisky Society, and was a global band ambassador for Glenmorangie. Hello, Annabel Meikle.
Good morning, Gordon. Nice to speak to you.
Lovely to speak to you. And how are you this fine day?
I'm very well, actually. I'm sitting at my wee desk in my office, which was hastily converted when we all started to work from home. And I was very lucky because I had just ordered some new equipment because I was aiming to work a wee bit more from home. And it all arrived on the Monday of lockdown. So I managed to install it all myself. So it's quite a nice wee setup, and I feel very lucky to be working from where I am.
I think some people will never, ever, ever go back to an office. They'll just have decided, you know what? Coffee is too good and I can watch Holmes Under the Hammer and nobody notices.
Well, for me, I'm looking out into my back garden and there's lots of birds in the garden and I can see them and I can see my neighbour bumbling around watering his veg, and it's very nice. Yeah, so I think we've all got quite used to it and not having to sit on the bypass for 45 minutes. And also the other advantage is only having to put your top half on and your lipstick on, and that's you ready for a meeting.
Exactly. And as I heard the other day, someone said, useless things you do. I put my perfume on before a Zoom meeting.
You're not dressed without your perfume.
So just to kick off, just for we're talking about whisky and all things whisky and a little bit about the Glencairn Glass, but can you give us a background how you got started in the whisky industry and why you got involved with the whisky industry?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a random story, really. I stumbled into it by complete chance. My background was in pottery. I ran a pottery business up in Aberfoyle for 10 years. And then I became a bit of a factory, so I decided to give it up. And I moved down to stay with my parents at the age of 29, which is never the greatest, but it was very nice, actually. And I was desperate to work, so I walked into the delicatessen Valvona and Crowler in Edinburgh, very traditional Italian delicatessen, and I asked them if they had a job, because in holidays I'd always defaulted to working in pubs or bars or, you know, hotels and stuff, because I love the hospitality industry. And they said, well, we don't really have a job, but you seem quite nice, so yeah, just come in tomorrow, and gave me a penny, and that was me. And I met some great people there, and one of them then went to work down at the vaults at the Scotch Malt Whisky Society in Leith. And she kept on saying to me, oh, Annabel, you just love this building. It's so amazing. The business is really interesting. And this whisky industry is just, it's just incredible. So eventually I trotted down the road and I went into the vaults. And I'm sure you know the building. It's absolutely stunning. You walk in and it's just got this really hallowed feel of, you know, a private club, but with big soft sofas and just this great array of whisky. But again, it didn't really have a job for me. So I ended up doing a couple of shifts on the bar and making sandwiches in the kitchen for James, the chef, who I knew. And that was it. I really basically had four shifts a week. And a really lucky break happened. One of the tasting and events managers left and they basically just gave me the job. I interviewed, but it was a, you know, I think I was the only person that did interview. And I started that. And literally a week later, they were running what they called Society Whisky School, which was run by Charlie McLean and the late, great Dr. Jim Swan, who I didn't know these people from, I didn't know them from a bar of soap. So halfway through the morning, Charlie sort of said to me, do you know that you've got a very sharp sense of smell? And I said, well, I have been told that once before. And he just said, I'm going to teach you. And so he did. So it was just about being in the right place at the right time. And it was a wonderful start. And what was great about the Scotch Malt Whisky Society was it was a really fantastic place to learn your trade, because I had no qualifications, no training. I just had this reasonable sense of smell, and I did the panels, and I really sharpened that sense of smell and how you describe them. And then gradually I sort of progressed through the business. And it was because it was quite small then, it was really easy to say, well, look, I've got this idea, should we just do it? And, you know, my then director would just say, yeah, just crack on with it. So it was a really great breeding ground, and it was a fantastic start for me in the industry.
And you moved on from there. But before we do that, you're talking about the sense of smell. It was funny when I was talking to Charlie, and I've talked to Richard Patterson, I've talked to quite a few of the distillers. It always amazes me when you talk to people that actually smell is so important in the whole thing. That, you know, as much as taste, as much as colour, as much as everything else that goes with it, they all put so much, you know, emphasis on smell as being one of the things that helps them most identify what the whiskey is, how it might look, how it might taste. And that always amazes me. So therefore, you having a very good sense of smell must have been a big win.
Yeah, I was. And it was lucky that I discovered it. I actually discovered it when I was working at the deli. And sometimes I'd get quite overwhelmed with the smells, because it'd be ground coffee and salami, and then there'd be food coming out the kitchen. And you'd walk into the shop in the morning and you'd be hit by it. And then by about halfway through the morning, you were acclimatized to it. And it wasn't until you were sitting on the bus on the way home that you went, oh God, yeah, my jacket really does smell of cheese and coffee and olive oil and everything like that. So yeah, it was lucky, and it's a massively important smell, and it's so underrated by most people that don't use the sense of smell in the industry, that it's seen as being a very sort of primeval sense, and it is actually the first sense that you use when you're born. And that's why when you smell things, it's very evocative, because it's locked within the memory part of your brain, and it's almost like a blueprint or a fingerprint. Every time you smell something, you then associate it with what you were feeling. Were you feeling safe? Were you feeling scared? And I actually also think that's why a lot of people say they don't like whiskey, is because they've had a bad experience of it. And of course, your nose is positioned right above your mouth for a very specific reason, is don't put something in your mouth if you've had a bad experience. So yeah, it's very powerful. And I think that's one of the things that always strikes me when people, you're doing tastings with people, is people never just go, oh, whiskey. They either go, oh my God, I love whiskey, or I hate it. And I love it when I get the hate it camp, because that's just a challenge. So.
Well, that would explain why I cannot stand the smell of Tequila Sunrise then.
Yeah, we've all had
community university. And after the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society, what was your journey to get you to where you are now?
Well, it was great. And what was exciting at my time at Scotch Malt is I started off at the Vaults, and then we identified that we needed another building. And I found the building at 28 Queen Street, and it was needing a massive amount of development, which took 2 years. But we opened that in 2004, and it was really flagship. It was really lovely to see it coming into business, and it had quite a different feel to it. And I think that it kind of attracted the attention of some of the bigger whiskey companies. And that after that, a few years after that, Glenmorangie bought the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society. And I think they liked the idea of having these kind of venues in Edinburgh. And that was at the time when they were developing what they called their new world. So they were redesigning the bottles, they were redefining the spirit, they were redefining the way that we spoke, and all the image of Glenmorangie and Ardbeg, but mainly Glenmorangie. And they advertised for a global ambassador, which was a new post to support Dr. Bill and his team.
Yep.
And amazingly, I got the job. So it was very exciting, because it was a new role, it was quite undefined at the beginning. And I kind of, in some ways, had to look for work. And then before I knew it, I had so much work on my plate that I didn't know what to do with it. And so my role was literally to go around the world and evangelize about these two brands, and sometimes come home, change my suitcase to some clean clothes and go off again. So it was an amazing experience, and it really allowed me to see how all the different markets operated. And that was one of the most interesting things for me, was to see how differently a campaign could run in Asia as to how it could run in the States, as to how it could run in the Nordics. And so a lot of what I did was come back with that information to help the marketing teams, you know, maybe channel certain product to certain markets. So it was a lot of fun, but very tiring. After 4 years, I thought, no, time to hang up my not very green footprint by that point. And I went back to the vaults for a couple of years, which was great. And then we did a big refurb there, which was, you know, quite a satisfying project to do. And then it was after that I was ready to set up my own business. And I set up a consultancy called The Whiskey Bell and basically just picked all the things that I liked doing. And it was really amazing. One of the really heartening things was to see where the work came from, because I didn't have any great strategic business plan. In fact, the original plan I had was for some kind of education program, and that went completely off the table. And writing work came in, and I worked with quite a few of the new distilleries, helping them get set up. So it was 2 years of a lot of hard work, not a massive income, but I really loved it, and I was very proud of what I created with that.
And then you made your way towards your journey to the Keepers of the Quake. I want to ask about that as well, but how did you get involved with the Keepers of the Quake?
Well, that was a long process, and Dr. Nick Morgan, who was obviously working for Diageo, contacted me and said, you know, there's an opportunity that's come up. It's not with Diageo, and I think you'd be good for it. And that was the initial conversation. And I'd literally just set up my business. So at the beginning, I was just like, yeah, throw my hat in the ring. And 2 years down the line, because that's how long the whole recruitment process took, just because of the way that Keepers is set up with its management committee and getting people together, by the second interview, I wanted that job more than I'd ever wanted any job I'd gone for. I was really hungry for it. But one of the interesting things was, because I'd never been inducted and I'd never been to a banquet, I didn't actually know very much about it. And we didn't have a website at that point. So it was really difficult to find out anything. So I just went in with my usual, you know, pretending I know it all kind of head. And went through a very big second interview. I think it was 8 or 9 of them sitting around a big board table, and then just me. So that was a wee bit scary, but we got through it. And I started in May 2015 with a colleague of mine who'd worked with me at Glenmorangie. And I knew that she was the only person I really wanted as my assistant, because we'd worked very closely there. And she just happened to be looking for a new job. So it was really serendipitous that it all just kind of came about at the same time. So we moved the office up from down south, and we realised we didn't need to be in the centre of Edinburgh. And I knew that with some office space off the bypass, which is really handy for the two of us, because I live in the east and she's the west, and they had one office space left, and we booked that one in and opened up the office with virtually nothing except two desks. We didn't even have a telephone, I don't think. And then a month later, the kind of things, everything got moved up, and we kicked in. And I'd been to banquet by this time, so I'd gone to the spring banquet as a guest, and it was just an evening I'll never forget, because it is such an extraordinary experience, the Keepers of the Quake banquet, because it's so much tradition and celebration and friendship, and there's 250 people in this room, and you probably know most of them. And it was a really exciting moment for me as I walked up the red carpet. I just thought, yeah, this is it. This is dream job stuff. So, but the flip side of the Keeper's job is quite not glamorous. People only ever see the bit where I'm, you know, walking around in a frock and high heels. So I call it the opera singer moment. They don't see the hours and hours of work that you're putting in. You're organising it, but I love organising big events, because it's all about the detail. It's about creating something that people are never going to forget. And a lot of guests will only ever come once in their life. So you've got one opportunity just to create something that they will remember and treasure and value. and make them know that they're really part of a community that is really special, the Scotch whisky collegiate community, that, you know, we all work together. And what I love about the Keeper's Banquet is these people from these companies are all competitors, and for 363 days of the year they're fighting it out for my market share. But when they come to the Keeper's Banquet, they leave their swords by the door, they come in and they drink each other's drams, and everyone gets a chance to speak to each other, and then they all go off at the end of the evening, you know, slapping each other on the back. So you kind of think, that's an amazing industry. I don't know any other industry that works so successfully in that way. And I think that's the strength of the industry that we have here in Scotland.
It's fantastic when you talk to the people we've talked to on the podcast. You know, competitors they are, and they're heavily competitive, but they're also friends, colleagues, they work with each other, they've got problems, they reach out. But just for the listeners, could you give a, just what is the Keepers of the Quake? What's the history? Just describe it for the listeners.
Yeah, okay. So I'd like to describe it as being the most inclusive but the most exclusive whisky, Scotch whisky club in the world, and that it's the kind of beating heart of the industry. And it was established about 35 years ago to recognise and reward that there was a role to be played to promote Scotch whisky in a really positive light, to bring it out to the world, but also to recognise the people that work all over the world doing that job for Scotch, and remembering that although it's brilliant that there's whisky being made all over the world now, Scotch is the original. And it was really as a celebration of that. And it's quite difficult to become a keeper. So you have to be nominated. And the nomination is for an outstanding contribution to the Scotch whisky industry. So it could be, you could be a distiller, a marketeer, you could be in logistics, you could be a writer. It really covers a very, very broad church, but it's a tough application process to go through. And we only ever induct 45 keepers at any banquet. So there's only ever been around, it's just over 2,800 keepers that have been inducted during our lifetime. So it's a hard fought medal. I mean, I wasn't a keeper when I started the job, and I was only inducted, I think, in my second year. Yep. And I remember thinking, you know, gosh, now that I'm reading people's citations, which get read out in the evening, gosh, you know, I even began to sort of doubt myself a wee bit, because you were reading about people with sort of 30, 40 years experience. So that's the keepers. And then what happens after you've been a keeper for a standard time, which is 10 years, but in reality is usually about 30 or 40. You then, if you've worked continuously in the industry, are eligible to become a Master of the Quake. And a Master of the Quake is kind of effectively like the OBE of the whisky world. So most of the other, I think all the other people that you've interviewed are all masters. And I think David Stewart probably has the longest years of service out of anyone, although Richard will be nudging him now. Yep. So that's very important. There's only about 200 masters we have. And we have these two wonderful events a year held at Blair Castle, which is our spiritual home. And people are inducted and then they come down, and it's a real celebration of all things Scottish. So we have traditional elements and then we have quite contemporary elements throughout the evening. Then after the banquet, everyone totters off home, and I then produce a magazine which follows on, which has all the wonderful pictures of the evening. So they're all the pages that people go to first. We have 10 international chapters. There was five years ago, and we've increased that. And that's really important, because that's our kind of, I call that, those my feet on the ground within markets like Germany, the US, UAE, India. And it really helps me to kind of keep the pulse of what's going on in that country. So that's wonderful. And they've been established for over 30 years as well. We have a scholarship with the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland, where we sponsor a scholar every year from the traditional music department, and they come and play at the banquet. And that's lovely, because that's really injects something modern and contemporary into the evening, which would seem quite traditional. And we recently just recorded a CD with them, which was sent out to all the members all over the world, which was to sort of effectively remind people of the night at Blair Castle. So that was very special and received really well. And then one of the other things that we've started in the last few years is we have our own exclusive Keepers of the Quay bottlings, which are only available to keepers. And we've done four so far, and we're now onto the fifth one. So that's been quite an exciting project. And again, it's about building engagement between the members. We've got a website page, we've got a Facebook page. They are closed, I'm afraid. That's where the exclusive bit comes in. But you know, it's a really strong little community, and it's been really interesting in this last period where people have been locked down, and seeing how people have become engaged with the website and the Facebook. And you know, if I just put a wee comment on the Facebook page, you know, I'll get hits from South Africa, Taiwan, you know, the Nordics, bing, 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 because people are looking and wanting to be talking to each other. And that's been a real positive thing that's come out of COVID-19.
And it's quite an exclusive club, as you say, but people know about it. Is there any wee secret you could tell the listeners that you're allowed to tell that they might not know about the Keepers of the Quake?
I'd have to think about that. I think probably one of the most interesting things are we have an after dinner speaker who can be any kind of interesting person, could be a celebrity, could be a politician. We have had Ronald Reagan, we've had Prince Charles, we've had Princess Anne. We recently had Rory Bremner, Frank Gardner from the BBC, Catherine Granger. So it's quite a range of different people, and they often say, there is a wee thing that happens at the end, I'm not going to give too much away, but it involves putting your foot on the table. And Annabelle Goldie said to me, if you told me I was going to be standing doing this on a Monday night in Persia, I never would have believed you. But people get into the spirit of the evening, and it's a great finale to the evening. So, yeah.
Well, the question we've been asking in the podcast is, one of the things that's fairly self-evident, whoever you talk to, is that whiskey has been just phenomenally successful around the planet, especially compared to a lot of other spirits out there. Why do you think it is? Why is whiskey so phenomenally successful?
Well, I often used to get asked this when I was travelling around the world, and I think one of the things is Scotch whiskey is so romantic when you look at it. You know, it's made in these beautiful little distilleries in beautiful surroundings. I mean, not all of them, but you know, that's the image we like to create for people. And it's a relatively simple process, but it makes this incredibly complex spirit. And it's so kind of elemental. And, you know, I always think that my theory is, it's my sort of terroir theory, is that spirit actually kind of takes on the character of the distillery that it's made in. So you'll get the amazing distilleries on the coast in Islay that create these generally robust, smoky spirits. And then you'll get a beautiful spirit in Speyside, and they're very beautiful distilleries, you know, like Strathmiller and Glenmorangie, that produces beautiful, very elegant spirits. So it's almost like they take on the character. And I think there's something about that uniqueness. And there's something then, therefore, that the person drinking that whiskey can then go, oh yeah, you know, that feels like a Lowlander to me if it's a single malt, or that feels like a very sophisticated blend that's been created with a range of Speyside whiskies. So it really speaks to you. And I think that's what encaptures people. And when I was traveling around the world, there was a few places and they were kind of like, really, is it really made in, you know, this beautiful building? And I was like, yeah, it really is, overlooking, you know, the sea or a loch. And I think people then feel a connection to it, and they feel a connection to Scotland, which is very, very real. And you just need to look at the tourist trade of people coming over to Scotland to festivals like the Speyside Festival, or just to tour around the Highlands, because they want to engage in that, because the whiskey has hooked them in, and it's a very powerful hook. So yeah, if you have whiskey, you will travel.
Yeah, and You must, the keepers of the Quake, I mean, you're talking about people in the, some of the people, as you said, like Richard and, you know, John, et cetera, have been in there for, like, how long, you know, how many years they've been in the industry. Where do you, what do you hear when you're talking to them and when you're talking to the people that you talk to on a day-to-day basis? Where do you think whiskey's going? Where do you think the whiskey and the, or the spirits world is going? What's changing out there?
Oh God, well, it's all changing at the moment. I think there are changes. I think people are being innovative. I like to think that it's not ever going to become too trendy. That's a very personal view, because I think things that become trendy then become untrendy again. But I think what I've enjoyed watching over the years that I've been in the industry is the much, much more inclusiveness of people drinking whiskey. So if you go to whiskey shows, it's not all just middle-aged men. It's, you know, you'll get boyfriends, girlfriends, and often it's the girlfriend that's bought the ticket. And you've got a really inquiring audience. And in the same way that people, as they were able to buy good wine in supermarkets, people were able to access good whiskey. And I think, you know, that has been the joy for me, is seeing how people didn't just wrinkle up their nose when they put a, you know, their nose in the glass, but they knew what they were drinking, and they wanted to ask complex questions about, you know, cask finishes and age and PPM levels on the barley. So really technical questions. So I think for me, rather than knowing what's going to the future, because I wouldn't like to guess.
Yep.
I like people being experimental with the way that they drink it. And I think people have become a lot more relaxed about that. I used to joke that there was this rule book somewhere that somebody had written about, you know, you can only drink whiskey in such and such a way, and if you're such a person and such an age and such a stage, you know. And I used to always say to people, you know, once the whiskey's in your glass, it's your whiskey. You can drink it the way you want it. So yeah, I think the, you know, people making good cocktails is a great development, because it's a sometimes an easier way in for people. I mean, whiskey's a strong spirit and it's quite tough. I wouldn't drink gin at 40%, or I wouldn't sit down and drink a glass of vodka at 40%. You know, I'd put tonic or something in it. So this sort of this rule that you can't put anything in your whiskey just puts so many people off, because it's strong.
Yeah.
So I think that's, for me, that's been the most interesting, to have seen what's happened. And I'll leave it up to the distillers and the master blenders to tell us what's going to be coming out in the future.
And the last question for me, we are celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Glencairn Glass, and there's like 25 to 30 million of the things out there, you know, the selling a shed load every year. Any thoughts on why a glass like that would be so successful? Why it's been so successful?
Well, it's just a great sturdy wee glass. I mean, from a very practical point of view, they're difficult to break, and so that makes me happy. We also used to have tumblers on the table at Keepers. Now, there's a lot on the table at Keepers of the Quake, and it just meant there was so little room. And now we have the Glencairn glass on the table, it's a lot easier to fit it on the table. And I think it's just, it looks better in anybody's hand, male or female. You know, there's that nice little stubby bottom that it's got, and you can do your swirling and your nosing, and you can look at your legs, and you can look at your colour. And we use the little glass droppers to add the water in. So yeah, for me, it's actually a very practical thing, and it's just a great wee glass.
Well, that's brilliant, Annabel Meikle. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. It's been excellent, and I wish you all the best going forward. And again, as I would say, thanks very much for Glencairn for participating in the Glencairn Podcast.
Thank you, Gordon. Nice to speak to you.
You've been listening to the Glencairn Podcast, celebrating 20 years of the Glencairn Glass, the world's favourite whisky glass.